Time for another Tacky Talk with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy. Tacky, happy February.
Happy February. Happy Groundhog's Day.
That's right. A little furball. Sorry, Shadow. So more winter on the way.
Well, we could run the show in continuous loop for 5 minutes. And we do 5 minutes of show and run continuous loop for the next 55 and see what happens.
Everybody will think they're watching Bill Murray.
Exactly. Although there's some sad news. Mel the Groundhog actually passed away on Sunday.
Oh, they had to have a replacement groundhog? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think they have to have a backup groundhog someplace. They only live about 3 or 4 years or so. But I mean, it's unfortunately the most recent ambassador of deciding whether spring is early had passed on Sunday prior to the big moment.
Oh, well, I think we're pretty much guaranteed more winter regardless. How did you weather the blizzard?
There was a bit of wind off the water. So, you know, it had some odd snow banking at the front of the house. So it was actually a kind of interesting snow. The back of the house did receive snow, but not nearly as much as the front of the house as the wind blew it over. A couple, 2.5+ hours of digging myself out. Thankfully, it was very light, very, very light snow. I'm very thankful for that. And I hope everyone else was able to weather the storm well. And most importantly, it seems like we were able to get through high tides in this storm somewhat okay. I'm not saying that there were no incidents of flooding or, challenged snow drifts, but it was closer to this time of the week where you get to a higher moon and closer to 12-foot tides, perhaps, and even higher if the wind's blowing just right. It could have been much more disastrous. So, very thankful that the city was extremely prepared, the state was extremely prepared. And I'm sure people are unhappy because the first major snowstorm results in some roads and sidewalks not quite done correctly, because it seems like every time there's a first storm, the first one's always the roughest on DPW. It seems like every year is the same way. I think it was a pretty well done job. And the storm that lasted slightly longer than we thought it would. I thought it came in a little later than we thought and lasted a little longer than we thought.
Yeah, and pretty amazing, though, that after 30 inches of snow here in Quincy, pretty much 2 days later, and things are running again back to almost normal.
Yeah, streets are a little bit tighter because, snow. Peeking around snow banks to drive is a little tough, actually, to get out for a short period yesterday. Things are, up and running again. And we're going to face another melting this weekend. So remember to please clear the drains around your house to get the water down. If it gets to a heavy rain, that snow becomes slush, that becomes water that could go into your home. So, please do look around the drains near your property and clear those areas out.
Yep. And fire department requests, if there's a fire hydrant near your property, try and dig that out as well. It might end up helping you, hope, God forbid.
Oh, absolutely. Some fire hydrants do have that 5-foot long wire pole above it. So despite the size of the snow, you should be able to identify and locate that. And try to clear as much of that out as possible for fire department. God forbid you actually need to get to that hydrant.
Yep, absolutely. And also, it is now the year of the tiger. So happy Lunar New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone. So suddenly, if I log on, hey, Fatra, say, hey, go home. So wish you all a fortune and happiness and good health. And the year of the tiger, I'm the year of the ox, which is the prior year. And thankfully, the year of the ox is now moving on very slowly and dinged up. But the ox does move on. And now with the year, I believe, is it the water tiger? I'm trying to remember which element it is, but it's a year again expressing some degree of caution. But again, it's stressing another year, good chance to renew your social bonds. Tiger years tend to be very passionate, very fierce, very outgoing, very enthusiastic. This coming year, is a bit more tempered.
At least to start, yeah, we'll have to see how it ends. The actual celebration by Quincy Asian Resources, as you well know, is going virtual because of the pandemic. It is February the 20th at noontime, and you can watch it here on QATV, of course, through Corey's various social media channels as well.
Absolutely. It's a good way of supporting the agency. And again, the agency had to pivot very quickly, just like last time out, where and there was hope that we could run an in-person event, and they had to pivot quickly. As the economy was basically running through its second phase of a rough patch, The last event was in 2020. Actually, I couldn't go to the 2020 New Year's because I actually had a fever, believe it or not. So that kept me from really making a strong appearance there. And yeah, you know, we lost an August Moon Festival in 2020, and we did a virtual 21 Luna Festival, and then we had a very scaled back August Moon, you know, in 2021. So we'll see what 2022 gives. Every time you think we make the turn, something else seems to happen.
It's true. You know, we haven't really talked a lot about, I mean, typically North Quincy High School would be full of 10,000 people for Lunar New Year celebration. And that has a significant monetary economic impact on the community, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. The festivals, you know, provide a chance for vendors to and not-for-profit organizations to showcase or promote themselves. Obviously, the agency makes money on these events to fund its finances. One of the nice things about these events is that since it's unrestricted income, unlike grant programs that have to use for certain programs, it helps keeps the lights on, right? This is the stuff that keeps the lights on, the rent paid, because the grants don't pay your entire rent. So, you know, these events are very important. And again, I remind folks they have a couple of pennies to spare. You know, find a local charity that you support and care about, especially if it's, you know, in the region here close to home, because they have not been able to have conventional fundraisers for the past year and a half, 2 years now. Actually, it is almost 2 years now. And, you know, they're all kind of struggling because even though unemployment rate has dipped below, I think we're down below. So last time I talked, I had 5.2. I think we're down another 1.1, so under 4%. You know, we still have, you know, a lot of folks that are in need despite the low unemployment rate. The food security is extremely high still in terms of food insecurity is still extremely high. And, you know, heating costs have gone up because of fuel prices, as we all felt. Everybody's felt the same thing. And, you know, incomes have gone up, but it hasn't kept pace with the price of inflation and energy.
Yeah, so no question. And there's also the whole, you know, social aspects of not being able to connect with your friends and neighbors at events like Lunar New Year. And, you know, I'm sure that has an impact too.
What's referred to as the shared experience,
Yeah.
right? The ability for people to share together an experience. This is why movie theaters have always survived home entertainment. You know, remember the story of the VHS was going to kill the movie theaters? It hasn't happened. It's not just because the big screens and the movie theaters have pivoted towards more luxurious or higher amenities, depending on how you want to put it, but also it's the shared experience. Same thing with sporting events, it's a shared experience. Whether it be, you know, collegiate, high school, little league, you know, or pro teams, is a shared experience. And same thing with festivals. You know, it's a shared experience to your family, shared experience to your friends, and to you know, also celebrate together, you know, in a forum that you know, that part makes you part of the larger community.
Right, yeah, a virtual experience is, you know, is a solitary experience. It's, I mean, it gets the job done, you know, for practical speaking, but certainly it doesn't fulfill that need of human interaction.
Yeah, and Lunar New Year is actually a big economic part of the different Asian communities that actually are practice Lunar New Year. Lunar New Year is mostly Chinese, Koreans, Japanese, Vietnamese, and a few others. Some other ethnic groups from Asia celebrate different holidays. For example, well, Cambodians do look at the Lunar New Year. Their big religious New Year holiday is in April, rotating around the life, death, and enlightenment of the Buddha. So again, I would remind folks, you know, Asian folks are all different, and that includes how we celebrate our New Year's, you know, revolving on different calendars based on what kind of culture and religion you're from, and things I've learned over the years, right? Everyone has a different way of going about what they consider to be the start of a year. So yeah, Lunar New Year's, you know, is practiced probably by over like 1.5 billion, 1.7 billion people. But again, there's so many other ethnic groups in Asia that they have, you know, different celebration periods regarding when the year starts.
Yeah, well, I think people forget sometimes it's Asia is a continent. It's not a country. It's an entire continent, you know, so
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, people forget that. It is a continent, you know, composed of, you know, almost 50 major ethnic groups and languages, and you know, almost all the major religions have some place in somewhere in Asia. But also there's probably you know, 50 to 100 plus other religions out there that you never heard of or know about.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, I mean, you could spend an entire lifetime, and people do, studying it, you know, studying the history and the culture.
No, absolutely. And, you know, COVID continues to have a huge impact there. You know, a lot of people like to travel for a Lunar New Year period sometime in the zone to visit family. Obviously, domestically, you try to get, you know, to visit people in your communities, but also, you know, outside of state. A lot of people like to travel in and out of different Asian countries to see family and friends and also see celebrations in other parts of the world. Everywhere celebrates Lunar New Year slightly differently. For example, one year, many moons ago, we actually went to Toronto for Lunar New Year. We did like the long weekend to do that. And, you know, Canada has a very large Chinese population, particularly in the Toronto region. And it was interesting seeing how it's done there, particularly such a big geographic zone. You know, it's not like a condensed city. It's just such a big, big place. And, you know, they have their own Chinatown and their own local organizations. And I got a chance to visit some of the malls and some of the, you know, equivalent of what Corey does on the entertainment. So it was actually interesting. But I've never experienced one in Hong Kong or any time over there. February is kind of a tough month to get out, besides being expensive, because obviously it's a high demand period. You know, it's hard to get away from work at this time of year. The legislative schedule is how I revolve my personal life. And I think people sometimes don't recognize that my life really runs the legislative schedule. So for me to take any significant period of time off is actually a little bit tricky.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I guess we should talk about shop, Tacky, the thing as you brought it up. What's going on Beacon Hill these days?
Well, today being Groundhog's Day, today is the final day for all joint committees to report bills out of committee. So right now they're preparing their paperwork as we speak and, you know, issuing email polls or some form of executive session via Zoom to vote on bills out of committee. So the bill has several options. You can vote it favorable, pretty obvious. You can vote on not to pass, also pretty obvious. And then there's two other procedural issues that you can move on. One is to put an extension order for a date in the future to report out, meaning that, you know, the bill is going to need approval by both House and Senate for a future date of report. There's also a study order, which people tend to mistake as a death knell. Ought not to pass is the death knell. The study order puts bills for further investigation by the committee. I refer to it as kind of a suspended situation that the committee, if so desires, can pull a bill out of study orders. It requires both the House and Senate chair to approve that, as well as the Rules Committee chairs, as well as having both branches agree to redirect the bill to the committee of origin or to another committee. So that's a study order. And then if you fail to report bills to one of those four categories, it becomes automatically or not to pass to the clerk's office. Yeah. But until the clerk reads the order onto the floor, you know, in a formal, informal session, it isn't happened yet. So, you know, my reports are filed, but until the clerk reads them into the record, informal or formal session, it hasn't officially happened. So some folks are probably like, oh, why, it's got to be up to the website right away. Well, it's not up to the website until the order's read. So it's going to take generally several sessions, informal sessions, to have the clerk read it. And normally what they do is they like to do it in bulk, meaning they don't read each individual bill. They bulk the bills and just read the bill numbers and try to do a one sweep of favorables and one. Well, study order doesn't have the real numbers. You just say it's a study order. But, okay. You know, you got 20, you got 28, or is it, no, is it 30, I think 31 joint committees all trying to get their bills out. So there's about 4,400 some odd bills.
Wow.
That are being reported out today.
Okay. So, yeah, in the interests of time, I can see where you'd want to consolidate as much as possible.
Yeah. Even with electronic filing, the clerk actually has to confirm, because of nature today regarding the fact that we really can't do paperwork in a conventional manner, we still have to do confirmation of the chair and committee votes and confirmation of the chair and committee action. So we actually have to follow up emails with the reports filed electronically to also reaffirm the committee's report. So normally, you know, I would be signing off a whole lot of paper, and you get a little small pile of paper to put my signature on. But you know, things are as they are. We ourselves have to pivot. So, I mean, people think the electronic age makes things so much easier. Well, it does and does not. Yeah, we're discussing that this week at staff, how it is easier and not easier at the same time.
Sure. Yeah, no, I get it. Where is the debate or discussion right now surrounding early voting, mail-in voting? There seems to be some disagreements on Beacon Hill about that.
Well, it's gone to a conference committee right now. It's actually part of a larger package relative to COVID assistance regarding testing and masks for schools. The Senate added another $20 million to that for community health centers and some other folks. So they're spending a bit more in the Senate than we planned to in the House, and also includes the primary days on that. Oh, I actually got my bills confused. Sorry. That includes the primary day. One reason I'm very obsessed with that bill is the primary day. We haven't approved the primary day yet. But in terms of early voting, voting expansion, both houses and Senate have a bit of a disagreement on that. But both of them actually do have some similarities as well, including extending time for voter registration,
Yeah.
continuation of early voting, that can people can vote. People have been practicing voting on city hall, other designated locations, if you want to vote in person. Ballot ballots, will be some permanency to mail-in ballots. I'm not sure how permanent. I don't know if it's going to be another time frame of expiration, or we're going to make this like a permanent feature. I think that's going to be a big part of the debate regarding the conference committee. And the idea of early voting, early same day voter registration and voting, is somewhat of a disagreement between the branches yet again. The concept of early voting has created the need or policy discussion change. So when long time when we talk about this idea of voting and registering at the same day, it was generally one day of election, November, and one day November. Now we're allowing up to 10 days prior to the day of election for early voting, which means it's no longer one day.
Right. Okay. So how do you feel about that?
Well, it's really about an infrastructure issue. I think people tend to forget what idea sounds good in the surface. Have you ever been a poll worker, a clerk, or visit a poll and you spend half a second looking around the room? It's an additional work for that person. So most of us who vote in person have the experience of providing your name and your address, and it takes some time to scroll through the big book and check you off. We add in voter registration. If it's a card-based voter registration, meaning you have to do it in writing, you have to now create a provincial ballot because you need a confirmation of identity and whether or not you have voted someplace else as a registered voter and things like that. There's the argument it's all electronic now, which is true. You can actually vote electronically. I'm sorry, not vote, register electronically, which we approved, I believe, 7 years ago now. It took about a year for technology to come up. And but again, while Quincy does have a strong internet backbone, not every city and town does. I mean, some parts of Boston, for example, doesn't have great internet backbone still. And the Cape, as I experienced through Zoom calls with my colleague Sue Moran from Barnstable, was very weak internet sometimes, very weak, as we discovered on our audio calls on internet, as well as parts of Western Mass. Plus, you need additional manpower. And in the case of multilingual cities like Quincy, especially Chinese and Vietnamese speaking population here, you actually have to go through the processes of explaining what's going on. People have this idea you shove it in people's faces and there you go, you're all set. People look at the form and want to know why, they have to pick a party affiliation, for example. Do they have to pick a party affiliation? Why do I need to give you all this information about my home address? Am I, what are the three basic checkbox? Are you resident age 18 above, US citizen, and have to prove or demonstrate residency of the place you are. Generally, that's done at City Hall. You don't actually have to produce documentation at time of registration. That's done on the other end. They do the cross-references and check the central voter database. So, you have that additional layer of work, which the clerks and no one's been able to explain how that would indeed work. And as I've said more than once to folks, the challenge of finding translators at a polling place is extremely difficult. I'm sure you can talk to Nikki about it. They only concentrate trying to find translators at locations of higher density Asian voters. But there are we're all over the city, and not just because you're in a high don't live in a high concentration area, that doesn't mean you speak English as a speak English as a first language. I mean, I remember going to Lincoln Hancock when he was very busy. A lot of non-English speaking Chinese were there, and it was extremely challenging for the poll workers to try to move people along as they're having linguistic challenges on on getting people signed in to vote. You throw in a voter registration component, and even if it's on a computer, someone's have to walk them through everything. And
it's getting time consuming, yeah.
Yeah, and get people to work that one day. I mean,
right.
You're gonna, how many people are listening to calls going to take a day off, actually more than one day off. You actually have to take a day off, another day off to do training. And, you know, you get, you know, slightly better than minimum wage, but if people are willing to take days off.
Yeah. It's asking a lot. You're right. Of the poll workers. Yeah, it is.
It is. I mean, and like I said, if you have, you know, look around the poll workers of Quincy and all that, I mean, you know what I'm talking about. It's a legitimately practical issue. So is it insurmountable? I don't think anything's insurmountable, but
right.
You got to really talk to folks. Well, I mean, you want a kind of election day challenge, you know? Hey, take a day off, folks. Get paid about minimum wage. Use up a vacation day and work the polls.
And it's all day too. Don't forget, they open at 7 in the morning. They close at 8 at night. So it is a long day.
Yep, my mom used to do that for a while up in Atlantic Meadows. Knights of Columbus.
Okay.
Atlantic Precinct. Because she was a translator. She did it for not quite 10 years, but. You know, it was a long day for her. She did get a lunch break, but, you know, she had to get there before 7 and she had to leave, you know, when polls closed at 8.
Yeah. And typically they'll after that too, for tabulation and, you know, cleanup and what have you. So it's a long day for not a lot of reward for sure. So that, you know, a great thank you to the people that do it for sure.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's, I know it's, you know, 1 to 2 days a year, or 3 if it's a primary presidential election. It's a long day of work and you got to stay alert.
Yeah, so we'll see where that goes. You know, we didn't talk about, Jackie, I wanted to get back to is what's going on in Asia. It's the Olympics. And it's a very different Olympics this year, for sure, because of COVID.
Yeah, the Beijing Olympics kicks off this Friday.
Yep.
And if it's anything like the 2008 Summer Olympics, I suspect it's going to be an incredible, incredible opening ceremony with nobody in the audience.
I know. It's the greatest party nobody came to.
Pretty much sums it up. And one of the arguments for Olympics is economic development, not just prestige. And it's actually going to be very rough in China, given the fact they still practice 2 or 3 week quarantine periods. They don't recognize non-Chinese vaccines as acceptable vaccines. It's going to be very different to have a huge negative economic impact because you expect hundreds of thousands of people from around the world coming in and out of there, plus, you know, the family of the athletes themselves. When your athletic event is done, what are you going to do, right? I mean, you're done early. You're going to enjoy the amenities of the community you're visiting, right?
Right.
You spend some money. You know, this is going to be a very interesting to watch, much like the Japanese Summer Olympics. I mean, the COVID controls are extraordinarily tight. But even then, you know, Omicron has been detected in communities around the Beijing Olympic Village. There have been Omicron detected on Beijing workers, the Beijing workers of the Olympics that are been segregated out from the Olympic population. Olympians will not be allowed in a country if they test positive. And if they somehow become positive there, they have to go to quarantine, which means that they have so-called backup Olympians. They have to be able to get on a plane at a moment's notice to fly out there and probably participate as soon as you get off the airplane.
Right.
This is pretty wild when you think about it. But I mean, the Olympians are shut off from Beijing. I believe NBC is going to announce the entire things from the studio in New York. It is time delayed, folks. So, you know, you don't really get to watch many live events because of the 13-hour time difference. But it, like the Summer Olympics, is going to be extremely, extremely different. And also there's a warning from the Chinese government not to make political statements. From the Olympians cannot make political statements while they are. I don't know what the consequences will be, but most people, you know, do realize that the Olympics have been a forum for political statements in the past by mm-hmm. many different folks, whether it be on the podium or through interviews with the local media or the international media. And was it last Summer Olympics? They had an individual from Belarus who sought asylum in Japan.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't expect anyone seeing asylum in China. However, given a lot of the news regarding human rights issues, you know, in China, the democracy crushing in places like Hong Kong and Myanmar, in Thailand, and you know, some other places of unrest. You know, maybe not. Olympics would make a political statement. I don't know yet, but it'd be interesting to see how it's handled. If it does, the international media will be watching very closely.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No question, for sure.
It's a great local politics too. I mean, Xi Jinping is looking for his record third term as president coming up this fall period, and a successful Beijing Olympics and a greater control over COVID and continuation of economic development were keys for him to win the approval of the Congress. And it is the Congress that elects the president over there. So, you know, if there's any, you know, failures in the Olympics or a COVID spread or economic fallout, just like any other place, the world that has some kind of electoral process, well, they don't have direct elections, you know, the Congress will take note and, you know, maybe decide they want to change leaders.
Yeah, seeing as we're on the topic of international issues, what do you think about the Russia-Ukraine situation now?
Well, U.S. planes have moved into NATO ally countries, and we have standby troops. And it's, you know, you look at 100,000 Russian forces, and you think, you know, 8,500 U.S. troops doesn't sound like a lot, but don't forget, you got the strength of the NATO allies in Ukraine, and the fact that we have enormous technical support to any friendly countries that we want to provide technical support to. And I have to be honest, I still think we have the best military equipment on the planet. Technology on the planet is still best in this country. Mm. So, you know, one soldier is probably better equipped, you know, total equipment-wise than any other soldier on the planet, in my mind. But, you know, that being said, again, Ukraine is not a NATO ally. It is a NATO friend. Big difference, obviously.
Right, yeah. Right,
not an ally. And, you know, billions of dollars of military hardware has been, you know, sent into Ukraine. And, you know, the fact that the former president of Ukraine has made an appearance there, you know, is an interesting part that's kind of been lost in the news somewhat, because he was a pro-Russia person that basically told Putin, go ahead, take Crimea, and, you know, the whole eastern side of my country, essentially what they did. And he got run out of there for doing that. But he's made a reappearance. So, you know, watch some international news. It'd be intriguing to see if there's an attempt at an internal political coup in the midst of all this as well. I think there's a lot of moving parts here that that we're not seeing from the U.S. media standpoint.
Mm.
But, you know, is there a war or not a war? I don't know. But I will say that the idea is to create a deterrence for a potential invasion if you put enough out there, that between economic sanctions and personal sanctions against the oligarchy in China, and not China, in Russia, the oligarchy. Actually, they are talking about sanctions to China's oligarchy too. But, you know, the Russian oligarchy put some sanctions up and then, you know, put a massive force up as a deterrent. Maybe there'll be enough to restart, you know, diplomatic conversations, which is right now, you know, Russia's biggest demand is that any former, you know, basically your former Eastern Bloc countries cannot be part of NATO, of which Ukraine is the first one they're attempting to do that with. And of course, Belarus is just north of Ukraine, if you look at the map. So, you know, that's a clear, they're a very friendly Russian ally. So, you know, it's also an interesting staging location. If Belarus gets into it, you know, there could be open war against a country that's also in turmoil between COVID and a large amount of political unrest. People have followed Belarus for last year. You know, there's been hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people protesting that president. You know, hundreds of people have died under that president's hands. I'm going to mispronounce his name because I can visualize, but I can't enunciate it. But, you know,
yeah,
you know, so, you know, it could, you know, result in a large-scale conflict with a smaller nation north of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But it could, you know, it could potentially have a ripple effect. I'm not saying it's going to happen. But unlike other military situations the U.S. have been, this is in the European theater, essentially. So it's not just us.
Right.
It's only 95% U.S. forces, 5%, you know, our allies, because frankly, we are like ginormous military compared to everybody else. We are like huge.
Right.
Yeah. Our allies. But this is a little bit different. It's a European theater, which means, you know, European countries all, you know, want stability in the region, and it won't be just the U.S., you know, going in there to try to find a peaceful solution.
And then at the same time, we have North Korea acting up again.
Yeah, it's a demonstration they can potentially hit Guam with their missiles. It's still unclear exactly what the nuclear program is, although people are thoroughly convinced that they do have some degree of nuclear capacity, whether it's ballistic capacity versus just dropping bombs on people. We're not clear. They don't exactly have the best air force. They're using a lot of antiquated stuff. But if you're really just out to bomb South Korea and Japan, you're not going that far in a map.
Right.
With planes. So, by the time you know it up there, you got to scramble quickly. And, it's a sphere of influence that involves China, Russia, Japan, South Korea, and of course, the United States. But it's really in, sphere of influence of three major powers. Anything they do, has a potential fallout with one of their neighbors. So, if they set up a nuclear device, it does have impact in China. The radioactive waste will go into the oceans and the air in the geographic zone. So, it's a little more complicated than just, hey, we're going to blow someone up and walk away. Your biggest financial supporter is sitting next door looking at you like, you better not set up nukes because we'll come in and step on you. It's interesting saber rattling. Historically, North Korea has always threatened military action in exchange for economic and resource assistance, largely in the form of fuel and food. They don't have a lot of fuel options in North Korea. And they have one of the poorer areas regarding agricultural development. They don't have a great economy on top of that, the way it's set up. So historically speaking, they start threatening and hope that people give them food and fuel.
A lot going on, a lot on the president's plate right now, for sure.
Oh, yes. And there's still Miramir out there, which has killed up to perhaps 1,500 or more people. And that military coup that's gone on for the past 6 or 7 months now. And the ASEAN countries, what ASEAN is, it's a bunch of Southeast Asian nations that have a sort of a interesting trading bloc and some freedom of travel movements in that area. And the Miramir is one of their representatives, one of the participating countries. And the other neighbors in Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam and Singapore and Indonesia, Philippines and Malaysia, ain't that thrilled about the current situation instability in that area. And it's inside the Chinese sphere of influence. The Chinese government has expressed minimal interest in trying to settle things over there, and that U.S., Australia, the European Union don't have a strong sphere of influence other than doing more sanctions. So that one is still floating out there as a UN crisis, as well as not too much further away across another country. Afghanistan is also delving into a humanitarian crisis as well. So there's a lot going on in the world. The president in the U.S. does have a strategic interest in those regions, largely because of trade. Those seaports and the waterways around Southeast Asia, I believe like 40% of what trade travels through that region.
Wow.
That actually impacts us as well. So, we do have economic interests in a stable area and free travel for all trade in the area. And of course, China is fighting with the U.S. and ASEAN and Japan and everybody else regarding how far a sphere of water influence they have.
Right.
Although half the joke is that it's tragic at the same time, is that climate change may resolve some of this force in a very tragic way for all of us, because obviously climate change is rising tides and that hurts all of us. But at the same time, those artificial islands that China puts up, as you read about it in the news, is actually going underwater.
Don't mess with Mother Nature.
Yeah, it's ruining all of us, but it's clobbering those artificial islands first.
Yeah.
So, and of course, we had that massive volcanic eruption. There's still Tonga, a country none of us knew existed.
Right.
A volcano went off the shores and caused a tsunami, and they're still having massive damage and humanitarian aid problems there, too.
Okay, so
lots of balls in the air,
yeah. Bringing it back home, I read an interesting article recently, actually, in Commonwealth Magazine about the power grid here in New England and how it's very tenuous, particularly because of the lack of natural gas and the high dependence of natural gas here in this region, especially here in the winter months. So the talk is that, yes, renewable energy is the future, but it's going to take a while. And in the meantime, we need to boost up the existing infrastructure.
Yes, this is not new news. As we migrated from coal and oil as electrical supplier, and we're still migrating away from oil as a fuel source for home heating. I mean, I think you heard the clanging in my house this past summertime, where we actually have converted natural gas from heating oil here. And all new construction does not use heating oil. All new construction is natural gas.
Right.
So economic development, natural gas is directly related. I remember talking to Nam Pham, who worked in the governor's economic development office, and about what's going on in Western Mass. He says it's hard to do economic development when they have no natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fuel for cooking, home heating, and it's a relatively stable energy source because, it's, you know, as long as the pipeline runs, you have electricity. So a place like Western Mass, for example, has huge storage tanks. The reason I know this is because I did some rate cases in the AG's office when I used to work there, and I had to do the Berkshire gas storage tank reveal. Yeah, things people don't realize what we do in the AG's office, the whether or not they intentionally or unintentionally overbought gas to sell at a later point, things that the AG tries to keep an eye on. So, but nowadays, you know, due to the desire for economic development, those gas reserves are not as full as they used to be.
Right.
Winter months, and that's challenging. And Massachusetts is a home heating state first. So when it comes to electricity or heat, heat is the priority in the wintertime, and we're forced to do spot buying in the open market for electrical suppliers, whether in or out of state, whether they're spooling up, dirtier sources or even renewable power that has access to us. You know, they do 15-minute spot bids, and it spikes the power prices really quickly. So even if, let's say, we decide to get, you know, hydro windmill from out of state on spot power, since it's a bid process, they're going to charge ginormous money, equally ginormous as if it was going to be fossil fuels. It's just who can get us the power the fastest. The grid system is old. I do remind people the electrical grid system is old. It does need upgrades up and down the whole system, not just the wires in front of your home. And that's paid out of your electric bill. And people do not want to pay more money. If you don't pay more money, you're not going to have new infrastructure. It isn't complicated, because when the rates are fairly not moving much, meaning they do go up, but they're not spiking huge, that isn't covering the cost of new capital. And when it comes to gas pipeline issues, we are at the end of the line. So I am aware there's a Halifax offshore LNG, liquefied natural gas pipe port there. The other one in the area between Halifax and next one up is actually out of Everett. Once you get past Everett, there's really nothing left.
Right.
Offshore gas coming onto the New England and Canadian region. That leaves you only gas pipelines coming in from the south and Tennessee. I'm trying to remember these maps off the top of my head now, as you can tell. It's been a long time since I looked at one of these energy maps.
Mm.
I mean, that leaves you the Tennessee pipeline coming up. So since, you know, Quincy in particular is literally at the end of the line, everybody else from the states going up suck down the gas before we do, and they have to keep putting more gas in the line to keep pressure high enough so it gets to your home here in Quincy.
Right.
As we want to do more economic development, housing, and growth, it's going to eat more gas, which means that it's going to, you know, cause more transmission line needs to keep pumping it heavier to try to meet the demand. And you know, there was talk about putting another transmission line coming north into northern western part, Canadian-Vermont border section, and huge resistance to that. And ultimately, they couldn't get the utility companies in New England to buy into that project to build that line out, which leaves them gas deprived. And folks are like, well, you can always truck it in, which is true. I mean, you can go to Everett, get to the big tanks, and just keep trucking around the state, but it makes it even more expensive and also environmentally not viable. It's economic and environmentally not viable, because now you got trucks in the road, which just adds to greenhouse gases. And we're trying to get natural gas, which is going to have the additional price of transport, which doesn't help customers or businesses.
Right.
So, you know, our renewable power options are available, but they're still years away. You know, the pipeline, the transmission line that needs to be built from Maine to Massachusetts for Hydro-Quebec has, again, been held up by Mainers, who doesn't want to do it because they don't perceive a lot of economic benefit, even though all the jobs are going to be in Maine. And the windmills are going up slowly but steadily, but it's not one ginormous window that's going to matter. It's hundreds of ginormous windmills are going to matter.
Right.
That takes time when you're building them in the ocean, trying to find solid bedrock. And as we all experience, nor'easters do like to come through here. And faster wind does not mean more power. As I say, you got to have the sweet spot, you know, the perfect zone of wind where it spins at a steady rate to create power well. So, you know, major storms and these giant windmills doesn't mean more electricity for us. They actually cause damage to the generation system.
Right. Sometimes they have to shut them down if it's too windy, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, because you burn out the turbines or cause the windmills to rip off. So you actually better letting them loose. Depending where you are, sometimes you're better off letting them loose and let them spin crazy ass, so to speak, and not let them burn out the turbines. So you're going to have to lock them in place. Like I said, it's case by case.
Yeah. Does it open up the door for nuclear again, do you think?
No, people are just afraid of nuclear. I mean, that's just what it is. People just don't like nuclear. They're afraid of nuclear. Even though nuclear technology has gone a long way regarding reusing old uranium, you can actually start reusing uranium for 100 more years and more. The French have been doing it constantly. French and other European countries have been nuclear for a long time with no incidents whatsoever. But people remember Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, the movie, the Andromeda. Was it the Manhattan Project? Was the movie
yes.
in the 70s that freaked everybody out? And, you know, Fukushima was an abnormality. Because of the tidal wave. I mean, that was a 8 point whatever earthquake. And
yes.
You know what I mean? So that was an abnormality. But you know, nuclear power plants, for the most part, has not been subject to terror attacks and, you know, highly regulated. Other than three incidents in that time, all of which there were almost no deaths really immediately. However, Chernobyl has long-term effects because of the different way that was a very different type of nuclear meltdown compared to Three Mile Island. But very low danger rate in terms of history. It is dangerous, but I mean, historically, there's been minimal. High startup cost to build, low energy over time because it has longevity. So it costs a lot to build one, but over time, as you're paying off the construction cost, your bills actually stabilize and go down because it has a 50 plus year lifespan. So, you know, part of energy generation is not just building it, is how many times you replace it. And things like big windmills are relatively new technology. So what is the long-term capital cost? Like, you know, gas fire and old dirty coal and oil, dirty coal plants, you know, they had a lifespan of 50 to 75 years for a plant. Once you pay those initial costs for capital early on, the capital cost kind of stabilizes over time as a predictable, but we still don't know what those capital costs and windmills and solar panels and whatnot. Hydro, we know. Hydro have been doing a very long time. We know what the capital costs are, right?
Yeah. You know, at Hoover Dam, right?
Hoover Dam, the dams in Quebec,
yep.
Long time. So we do know what those capital costs are going to be. They're fairly predictable to the customers and what they're going to have to pay to help keep those facilities upgraded. But like I say, it's still unpredictable. We don't know. It's very new ground we're still playing, and I know the technology has been around a long time. But the scale we're looking at is so big, particularly the windmill project. You know, time will tell. I can't predict what it's going to look like. And I don't think people can until, you know, a Category 2 hurricane runs through, right?
Yes. Yeah. Not if, when, exactly. Yeah.
So, nuclear. People don't like it.
We are actually approaching the end of the hour, believe it or not, already, Tacky. But good time to let folks know how to get hold of you.
617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. Just give us a ring and mash a button, as I like to put it. You can always email me at tacky.chan@mahost.gov. I don't know why I spell my name, because you guys have it at the bottom of the screen. It's like silly of me. It's like after like almost 2 years, I'm realizing I'm still spelling my name.
Well, no, it's okay, because this is an audio program also, so it's good for you to do that.
Oh, so the people that can't see me. Oh, well, we probably should keep that. We probably shouldn't let people see us. It's probably better off.
As I always said, I had the perfect face for radio. So,
given my poor haircuts, I think I do too. You guys can watch my last executive session on my State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook page if you want to see my last executive session. Still recorded there live. And Tacky Chan ORG is in the process of a facelift as we update information regarding local services. And we're working on that right now. So players get to me. My email box have been settled down a bit. The last month has been a flurry of emails from people who want the committee to report bills favorable or unfavorable, depending on what side of defense you're on, as both constituencies and out of Quincy folks, because I'm a chair, mm-hmm. asking for this favorable or unfavorable on bills that were sitting before my committee. So my email box is calmed down for now until we get to the budget. Once we start budget process.
All bets are off, yeah.
All bets are off. We're back to 300 emails a day.
Yep, everybody wants a piece of the pie, sure.
Not including the junk mail box they have to look through, because sometimes stuff ends up in junk mail. So actually, there's a funny one here too. They decided to, the last couple of years now, they've used email systems to do our scheduling for Ways and Means chairs. And ended up in junk mail.
Really? Oops.
Yes. So thankfully, I do look at my junk mail every 2 to 3 days just to scan through, make sure we didn't miss anything. I was scanning through. I was like, request for a setting meeting with Ways and Means Chair on the budget. I'm like, how did this end up in junk mail?
That's kind of important. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of important. So, folks, remember to look at your junk mail. You may find something very, very important in there.
Sounds good. All right, Tacky, thanks a lot. Any public appearances that folks can see you at in the near future?
No, actually, my schedule is actually all Zoom-based. I mean, like yesterday, I did a speaking engagement with Braintree High School students as part of the new year. I know it's not in Quincy, folks, but I do take requests from anybody and try to be helpful. And you know, I was actually on NPR for a little bit yesterday, talking about the new year, and we just, before we started today, we got a request from CityLine to talk about Lunar New Year and Asian issues. Whether or not we can make that CityLine interview happen, I don't know yet. We're still trying to figure it out. But, maybe you see me someplace else besides being here on a flat screen.
All right. Well, just remember, we had you first.
Absolutely, Joe. Absolutely.
Check in with you next week. Thanks, Tacky.
See you next week, Joe. Thank you.